Well, welcome to the pre-show, the show before the show. Cleola Brown of the A. Philip Randolph Institute is here, and also we're going to talk to author Ian Millhiser. We're trying to get his connection in now from the Center for American Progress. He's the editor of Think Progress Justice. We're also going to give away 2 signed copies of his book here. You're going to enter today. We'll announce the winner next week during our show. All you have to do is write the word court in comments, even if you're watching the replay. We'll leave it open until Friday morning, 9 a.m. Eastern Time. It's 2:59. We have about 1 minute, and I'm going to give Cleola 1 minute to tell us about a 10-year-old that she has at the APRI conference.
Well, it would take forever to explain just how magnificent she is, but in a nutshell, this young sister, at 10 years old, is doing what we encourage all of the adults to do, which is to engage, and engage from a level of sincere dedication about the importance of voting and about the importance of registering. But more than that, she is just so articulate explaining where the power that people possess comes from.
Well, we can't wait to hear way more about her, because I think she's going places, and I can't wait to see where she is at age 21 or 22.
Incredible.
It is 3 o'clock, so let's get started.
Activate your voice!
Fight for your right!
Speak up!
Speak out!
We're union, and we're proud!
Go Union!
Welcome to Activate Live, the Machinist Union's weekly show for and about working families. I'm Tanya Hutchins, coming to you live from our Maryland headquarters. We have 2 very inspiring guests. Inspiring because their work motivates us to dig deeper to create positive change. But first, here's the latest IAM news. The fight to save jobs at Red River Army Depot in Texas is far from over. Nearly 600 NEFI IAM members have been laid off at Red River, and more workers are slated to lose their jobs next month. The IAM's legislative team has met with U.S. senators and representatives on Capitol Hill, resulting in a joint letter to the commanding general. And we're going to keep you up to date on what happens as we keep the fight going behind the scenes. IAM International President and Navy veteran Bob Martinez placed a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier at Arlington National Cemetery last Saturday as dozens of Machinist Union members observed the ceremony. Now, some traveled from as far away as Wisconsin to attend. The tomb is dedicated to U.S. service members who died without their remains being identified. The event was arranged by the IAM Veterans Department. And from our Midwest territory, IAM District 77 members and their families gave back to the community recently. It was part of the Midwest Territory's IAM Helps in the Community program. Now, Helps stands for something very important: honoring, engaging, lifting, providing, and servicing. 20 volunteers in Minneapolis helped the Community Emergency Services food shelf facility with repairs. Now, our first guest has a special relationship with the IAM because of the history her organization and our organization share. And I'm reading weird because my prompter just crapped out a little bit, but we're going to tell you about the passion behind her work for equal rights. So the A. Philip Randolph Institute, or APRI, is the senior constituency group of the AFL-CIO, and our union is tied to APRI historically. Here's a timeline that we're going to put up on the screen for you. In 1925, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters was founded. In 1978, it merged with the Transportation Communications Union, or TCU. And then in 2005, TCU and IAM agreed to merge. And that merge was completed in 2012. Now, Cleola Brown is APRI's president. She's the first woman president, and we are so proud of her. We've been trying to get her here for a long time. I know you were here a year or two ago and did this great interview with Deirdre Konievsky. So we said we have to get her back, so thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tanya.
I wanted to let you know that when I was looking up a lot of the history of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, I read about how the porters were in this bitter fight with the Pullman Company. And for 12 years, the company didn't recognize the porters. They had to fight for that first contract for 12 years. But they fought through and they got that contract. Mm-hmm. So what does that say about the determination and the resolve of the Porters?
One thing I think that resonates from the history of the Porters is that they understood that just getting the contract for themselves was not just about them. It was about all of the families that lived up and down the East Coast corridor. Because African Americans who worked on the railway carried the news of what was happening for jobs, what was happening on the discussions about civil rights, and the connection to family. And these Porters were used to putting up and putting out, putting up with just about any kind of adversity that they met, but remaining very dignified because they represented a new chapter in the legacy of how is it that you work with dignity and you work with pride.
You know, I've heard you say that money cannot buy dignity and
no,
respect.
No, it can't. No, it cannot.
And I would think that that should be easy for people to understand in companies.
Well, I come out of a factory, all right, and I can only speak plainly and directly. I don't know how to dress it up, shine it up, and make it sound pretty. That's not who I am. But one thing that every worker who's ever worked in a plant or a factory or even in an office format understands is that when you walk through the door at your employer's business place, you should not leave your dignity at the door for a paycheck. It doesn't work like that. That's why unions are so important. We are able to negotiate for our rights. We are able to negotiate for benefits. But we are able to remain who we are, true to ourselves, and representing who we are in a very proud way. And our work should never diminish that. The size of a paycheck should never diminish that.
So how did A. Philip Randolph, did he fall into this leadership position, or is it something that he was doing behind the scenes?
I'm so glad you asked that.
Because we don't talk about him enough, yes. We have to educate people who don't know about him.
Randolph's parents, from Florida. Mm-hmm. His father was a minister. His mother was traditional, a housewife, watched the kids, the rest of it. Very strict disciplinarians, making sure that the kids were okay and that they were representing the community in the kind of lifestyle that every African American was striving for then. Because it was that period of time where we had to prove that we were just as good or better than, certainly better than what was being portrayed about the African American race. But Randolph was raised as an educated black man. And you know the difference, you know how sometimes, and I love teachers because I have a secondary education career myself, but teachers were taught to be above the rift. So he had been groomed to be just that. But the pride that he saw his father display as a minister, as a mentor, as a leader in the community is what grabbed him. So as he left Florida and went to New York, he did what was expected of him, which was to develop a paper called The Messenger that talked about everything that was going on in the community and to do the accepted step of becoming better than. But he also had the opportunity to meet some pretty incredible people. People who were working the railroad, who talked to him about pride, who talked to him about dignity, who talked to him about the struggle, and he was hooked. Didn't have a dime to his name, because as an educator, just like today, it was a struggle to pursue education and have finances to do other kinds of things. Teachers are struggling even today.
Yeah.
But Randolph was smart enough to marry up. He married a woman who was a hairdresser, and you know, black women gonna get that hair done.
Yes.
And in getting to know her, he was able to even listen a little bit more intently to what the cause was that they were coming to him for. The Porters appreciated how he was able to express himself. They saw that he was a man that could speak with dignity and clarity. For whatever level the audience was at, Randolph had that communication skill to reach everyone. And they recruited him and taught him why he should be in the labor movement. So he didn't go after it, they went after him.
Now, when did he meet Bayard Rustin?
I guess it was about 6 years after he was actually into what he was to do in the organizing effort. You know, Bayard was a special individual, took no crap from anybody. Hope y'all are not offended by the word crap, because
I know we've said it twice during the show already.
That works for me.
I said it, you said it.
When he met Baird, Baird was the organizer, really. Randolph was the educator. Baird was both smart and he was also very concise. And as an openly gay man who never hid that for one second, he called to question the sincerity of equality to all. And there was nothing that Randolph liked more than a challenge. And he was always true to his word. When they met, they decided what was to be important in this movement towards social justice. Not social service, because that was not the goal. Social justice. And together they made the most dynamic duo that you can imagine.
Now, you made a point in your first speech as president to mention Bayard Rustin mm-hmm. and the obligation of APRI to him. Mm-hmm. What, you got a pretty good response to that. Why was it so important for you to make sure that you mentioned that?
Well, for years, you know, Bayard had done a lot of things and given credit to a lot of people for the work that he actually performed, because the church plays a huge role in what African Americans will do on their strategies, on their buildings, and all the rest. And Dr. King, along with a number of other people who were involved in the movement, thought it best perhaps that he not be outright displaying who he was. And that was not the true sense of what the Institute was to be about. And to Randolph's credit, he said, Rustin is who he is, and because he is who he is, the Institute that we're fighting to form and the practice of social activity and social rights and civil rights will come out of respecting everyone's right to be themselves. They used to hide him in the trunk of cars because ministers didn't want him in the church. He was never really asked to speak. But because he was so magnificent, they had to put aside those prejudices internally to allow his magnificence to come to the top. And God, are we lucky for it. But coming in as president, I knew right away that if I was going to be true to this job, I had to be true to all aspects of it. And you know as well as I do, the labor movement was not always warm and fuzzy to people who were from the LGBTQ community. And it took a while to even form Pride at Work.
That's right. I think it was something like 1994. Mm-hmm. Now that you bring up Pride at Work, mm-hmm. what about the importance of making sure that all of us work together, no matter what constituency group we're in, that APRI works together with CPTU and works together with Pride at Work?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's important because it represents every aspect of who workers are. And to work together to address what is the primary principle and role for each worker, because they choose where they want to be an activist. We have to understand what each other does and respect that and help to grow that. Inside of APRI, for example, we have four brand new chapters across the state of North Carolina. And those are young activists who happen to be from the LGBT community. So they said, we love APRI, but we also want to be activists in the honor of Rustin, because he was not afraid, so they're not afraid. And my God, are they tearing it up. So I said, okay, cool. But what we're going to do, I'm going to put you with some of our Pride at Work activists, and let's see what we can do together to help this team and this movement grow inside of the Black community, which is a structure for APRI, inside of Pride at Work. We met years ago, my first year, as a matter of fact, with the National Board of Pride at Work. Some of my board members almost had a stroke because some of them were ministers, and they were like, we're going to meet with who?
So that stigma is still there, isn't
it? The stigma is still there, not to the degree that it once was, mm-hmm. but we are a society that is learning how to be more accepting of all of our differences. And that's why it's important that we not hide it, that we put it right out here and say, this is what it is. Now let's deal with it. And that's in every respect, because women weren't exactly high-flying and up front and accepted and pushed either. Mm-hmm. not in any of the organizations except CLU, and we thought we were going to lose our jobs if we stood up inside of CLU, but thank God for the women who put that piece together and fought really hard to recruit women from all of the unions to make that happen.
Powerful women.
Hey.
There's power in numbers.
Hey.
Well, we have a conference coming up pretty soon, next month.
Yes.
It's the 49th National Education Conference.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about this theme, staying woke and fighting back.
Well, we try to stay relevant, and because we have a large group of young people, they keep this old lady right here on the top of the language that makes sense. So Stay Woke was a record that they were always singing and cutting up to, for lack of a better term. And when I listened to it very clearly, it was a message, a movement message inside the record. And that became our theme last year. And as we saw this administration roll its program out, we're a nonpartisan organization, but we are very particular. And we are particularly interested in making sure that the policies of this administration are impacted by our activism, which is to turn them around. So we are staying woke to what's going on, and we're still fighting because we don't give up.
So what do you hope to accomplish at this year's conference in terms of making sure that everybody has an action plan when they go back home?
Well, we decidedly pull the pieces that impacts our community the most and spend the time to explain it so that when we get the dialogue from our membership and leadership from around the country, we know exactly how it's playing out in the communities. I've never seen the media play such an active role in spreading the word, and not always a truthful word, of what is taking place. So we truth speak to what is doubly spoken to as far as policies are concerned. It's like from the time they started to talk about right to work. We all know and understand that it was right to work for less.
For less.
Okay? So we take the mystery out of dialogue like that and make it plain, so that when people are recruiting and talking to people in their communities about why it's important to be an activist, they can do it in a way that makes some sense. We teach folks how to speak to large groups of people. We teach folks how to maneuver in large meetings so the parliamentary procedure becomes a way of getting a space in any space to speak, because it then calls for the dignity and respect of being heard. We teach young activists that they are just as important and their message means just as much as the elders.
And that is really important, because a lot of times young people may think that no one does listen to them, or older people are trying to tell them what to do.
Absolutely.
You know, so I think that's very important.
Absolutely.
I know you're busy, and we're going to let you go, but before you do, we're going to look at some of these comments, because you're getting a lot of thumbs up here.
Oh, my.
Pamela Robinson, Madeline Anderson, Dina Park says she loves that term, above the rift. She loves it. Rhonda Rogers says she loves your work and leadership. Jim Price says, Clay, I'm so proud to be on your board.
We're proud to have him. He's amazing.
And John Lacey says he's watching from the NAACP Labor Luncheon in San Antonio, Texas. Thank you, John, for watching. And a lot of great comments here. There are people watching from Arkansas. It looks like Annette Piscoya.
Oh, my.
All over. So thank you so much for being here. Is there anything
thank
else you
Tanya.
Want us to know leading up to this conference?
For those of you who are not yet registered, we'll see you next year, because we're oversold and the hotel is accepting nothing else. But I tell you what, because the machinist and Bob Martinez, who is absolutely an amazing leader, has been so supportive, we are going to be able to stream from the conference with the help of Jim Price, our board member. We are going to be able to go. We can't do Periscope yet, but through the Media Cafe, we hope to have it up and running by the time we get done. So we encourage you to please tune in and watch us either make it good or mess it up, and you tell us how we can make it better. We love the audience that generates from APRI, but also from CBTU, from Pride at Work, from CLU, from APALA. That's the family.
Well, I'm so sorry that I'm going to miss it this year, but I know we have a good Machinist Union delegation
going. Yeah, you do.
So I'm going to check out that stream.
Thank you.
When I can, and look forward to going next year.
Tanya, thank you for having me.
Thank you. Come back anytime.
I appreciate that.
And yeah, we'll have a part of the APRI conference next week. So if you would like more information, all you have to do is go to the website here. It's www.apri.org. That conference is the 8th to the 12th of August in Phoenix, and the theme is Staying Woke and Fighting Back. So we hope that anybody who has more information that they need to get it will go to this website right here and check it out. It has all the information that you want on A. Philip Randolph Institute. Was I saying it wrong, Bayard? Is it Bayard Rustin?
Bayard.
Okay, see, I learned something today. It's Bayard Rustin and Cleola Brown. Check out apri.org. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And if you would like to comment, you can continue to do the comments. You can comment on Facebook on this video right here, even if you're watching the replay. You can hit the reply button on Twitter and let us know what you think about anything that you've just heard. And if you're watching on YouTube, there's a live chat feature, so you can do that as well. And we really appreciate all your comments, so that'll be good. Our next guest has an important perspective on the Supreme Court amid its newest member, Neil Gorsuch, and recently announced nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, by looking to the past. Ian Millhiser of Justice is the Justice Editor of Think Progress, the news site for the Center for American Progress, and he's the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Now, we're going to give away two signed copies of his book, so just write in comments to enter. And the word that you have to write is court. Just write that word court in comments. But you have to like and follow our page to be eligible. Well, Ian Millhiser joins us now from Washington, D.C. with details about Injustices. Thanks for joining us, Ian, and taking the time.
It's good to be here. Thanks so much.
So, Ian, what was the impetus for this book?
Well, I guess the impetus was I was asked to work on the first case challenging the Affordable Care Act, the NFIB case. And I remember when I was first asked to work on it, my response was, well, I'm thrilled to do it, but is this really necessary? Like the idea that the Supreme Court would step in and overrule a massive economic regulation providing people with health care, that just wasn't on the table, or didn't seem like it was on the table back in 2009. And when the Supreme Court took that suit seriously, it made me realize that the other side has grown more ambitious. It made me realize that a lot of the past things that the Supreme Court did maybe 100 years ago that we thought were dead could very easily be revived. And if, you know, Brett Kavanaugh joins the Supreme Court, I think we're going to be in for a world of hurt in terms of what the Supreme Court is going to do to people who aren't very rich and very white and very well off.
So, Ian, let's go back in time a little bit. Paint us a picture of what it was like for an average worker in the 1900s, right around the turn of the century.
Well, it was grim. I mean, you had legalized child labor. In some cases, you had children as young as 4 working in factories. The era about 100 years ago is often referred to as the Lochner era, after a case called Lochner v. New York, which involved New York bakers. And the bakers in these bakeries would work in these terrible conditions. The floors would be rotting. Sometimes there would be raw sewage dripping from the ceiling. There would be roaches all over the walls. It would be hot because the ovens were going all the time. They would sometimes work 18-hour days, 6 or 7 days a week, more than 100 hours a week. They would have to sleep on the very same benches where they were kneading the dough and making the bread. And they were paid a pittance for this. I mean, the equivalent of maybe $10,000 or $11,000 a year if they were lucky. And those were the conditions they got, I guess, in the free market. That's what they got without the government stepping in. What the Supreme Court said in the Lochner case is they said, oh, well, you know, the government, you don't need the government to protect you because you have your own bargaining power. And so Lochner struck down a law that would have reduced their 100-hour work weeks to 60-hour work weeks. And the Supreme Court said, oh, no. If you can't negotiate for a 60-hour work week, if you can't negotiate that down, that's your own fault, because you should be able to negotiate. The government shouldn't step in to help you.
Now, I saw a stat in there that just seemed awful to me, and I forget which chapter it was in, but it said something like 7,000 people died in boiler explosions in the U.S. between, I think it was 1883 and 1907. It's so hard to even comprehend now that was like a way of life back then.
Right. I mean, like, there's two things that have happened between now and then that have made it so that workers don't live in that world. One is unions. You know, one is the fact that workers gain the ability to combine together and match the power of management by working collectively. And the other is law. The other is the fact that, you know, we now have a minimum wage. We now have safety standards. We have, although workmen's compensation, you know, hasn't worked out as well in the modern era, it was better than what came before, which was if you get injured, tough. You know, so we have laws protecting workers. And what's so frightening to me about the turn that the Supreme Court is taking right now, if you look at their civil rights cases, if you look at their forced arbitration cases, if you look at their efforts to dismantle unions, they are dismantling the systems that we built over the last 100 years to make sure we don't go back to that world where children are working in factories, where workers are working ungodly hours in squalid conditions, and where people's jobs just fundamentally are not safe.
I couldn't believe reading through it. I think one of the cases was Hammer versus Dagenhart, I think from 1918. You know, we've been looking at some of these pictures of children that were working at a very young age with child labor. Tell us a little bit about what Hammer versus Dagenhart decided.
Sure. So Hammer was a case involving southern cotton mills. At the time, the South was very poor. And so the northern capitalists moved their cotton mills to the South because they could go there and they could say to these poor farmers, you know, if you want to come work for us, you don't have any other options. So if you want to work for us, you can only come do that if you bring your children too. And so entire families would go into these cotton mills. Like I said, you'd have kids sometimes as young as 4 working there. Hammer v. Dagenhart was a case brought by these cotton mill owners to strike down a federal law that banned child labor. And so you had the Supreme Court of the United States saying that child labor was not something the federal government could do anything about. If you know you wanted to have a child labor law, you had to look to the states. And the states wouldn't enforce their labor laws. The reason they wouldn't enforce their labor laws is because North Carolina wanted to encourage those cotton mills to move from Massachusetts to North Carolina. And the way to encourage them to do that was to have lax child labor laws. That was actually an enticement that the southern states used in order to get people to move their factories into their state.
So now, today, I would think that if someone said, oh, your kids have to go to work, people would be up in arms.
Yeah, I mean, you would. I mean, I think you're right. I mean, I think it would be very tough to imagine waking up tomorrow in a world where 6-year-olds are working in factories. But these things happen gradually. I think that, you know, the fact that we have the man in the White House right now, that we have in the White House, I mean, I don't think anyone could have imagined 5 years ago, much less 20 years ago, that we would be at the point where a Trump presidency would be realistic. If you look at the court's forced arbitration cases, where, you know, first they said that you could be forced to sign away your rights to sue someone if they sell your product and it doesn't work out. And then they said they could force you to sign away some of your rights in the workplace. And then they said they could make you sign away your rights to be free from anti-discrimination law. And they just said, you know, very recently this past term, that your boss can literally say to you, you're not allowed to sue me in a real court. If I break the law, you have to go to this privatized arbitration forum where I'm going to pick the arbitrator. And if you don't agree to sign away all your rights to sue me if I break the law, you're fired. You know, that's what the Supreme Court just said last term. That didn't happen overnight. That happened over the course of 30 years. So I think that, yeah, I mean, it is hard to imagine waking up tomorrow in a world that looks like what the world looked like 100 years ago. But I don't think it's impossible that we wake up in that world 40 years from now if we continue along the path that we're going down.
What do you think it's going to take to get through to people that this chipping away at our rights and even the Voting Rights Act being gutted, what do you think it's going to do to get through to people that this is a real possibility, that we can go way backwards?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's only two things we can do. We can talk about, I mean, I can come on your show and I can scream it from the rooftops, and we need to make sure people know about it. We need to make sure that unions are warning their members about this. We need to make sure that politicians are warning their voters about this. And then the other thing we can do is vote. They haven't yet taken that away, although they are on that path. But, the Supreme Court has not yet taken away that right. That means, in 2018, people need to show out. In 2020, people need to turn out. And, there is a way that we can put this on a different path and gradually, slowly bring things back. But it's going to take a continuous effort. The way we got to this point, where Kavanaugh's about to come onto the court and gut our voting rights and gut the rights of people in the workplace, is that a whole lot of people on the other side, a whole lot of conservatives, a whole lot of managers, a whole lot of really wealthy people, they all got together and they worked really, really hard for a really long time. And the only thing we can do to fight back is all of us have to get together, and it has to be a whole lot of us, and we have to work really, really hard for a really long time.
You talked about hope and turning things around. And before I ask you how you hold on to hope, if we go back to the Depression and FDR, he was able to turn things around economically. Can you talk a little bit about the end of the Lochner era and how FDR was able to turn things around? Because things could have been differently at the Supreme Court back then.
Right. I mean, we got lucky. So we got lucky because when the crisis hit and we got the Great Depression, FDR was elected. FDR, he viewed the president as a job that was about experimentation. He just kept trying things to try to fix the problem, and when it worked, he kept doing it. He had a Supreme Court that struck down a lot of that, but they had maybe a 5-4 majority, and one of them got spooked because FDR was very popular. So we got lucky in that the Supreme Court wasn't able to hold on to its opposition forever. We got lucky because we had a president that was looking to solve problems. And we also got lucky because we had a president who was still committed to the notion of us being a liberal democracy. I mean, FDR could have become a dictator under those circumstances, and that wasn't what he wanted. I mean, the way that a European friend of mine once explained the 1930s to me was, you got Roosevelt and we got Hitler. So, the danger when that crisis hits is that you're going to have some sort of massive change, and you don't know what that change is going to be. When people get desperate, they start reaching for new alternatives, and if you're lucky, they reach for someone like Roosevelt, and if you're unlucky, then, things can get very bad very fast.
Yeah, we just had the picture up there of Justice Owen Roberts, and we were lucky that he switched his vote at the time that he did. Or things could be much different today.
What probably would have been different? Owen Roberts was the justice who said, "Okay, I'm going to stop blocking the New Deal now." If he hadn't done that, where we would have probably wound up is court packing. FDR said that he was going to add more justices to the court in order to allow our democracy to continue to function. And I guess, now there's another justice named Roberts on the Supreme Court. And what I hope that he understands is that he has a choice to make, too. I'm not expecting John Roberts to hand down all sorts of decisions that I like. But if we continue to have free and fair elections in this country, if we continue to have a system where we can resolve our disputes peacefully and through the democratic process, then I'm willing to fight him and his side in that arena. If he decides to push too far, he tries to hand conservatives permanent victories, then I think that you're going to see future presidents having to make very difficult decisions about how they deal with the court and whether they need to think about undermining the court's power in ways that haven't been on the table since the Roosevelt administration.
in If We Get Back to Basics, remind people what the fundamental role of the Supreme Court and the justices are.
Sure. Well, I mean, the fundamental role is to make sure that the law and the Constitution is enforced. And it's part of the reason that the court is so dangerous, is because you can't not have a judiciary. Like, you can't not have a body that's independent, that's, you know, separated from political actors, whose job is to just, you know, apply the law to each case that comes up. But the problem that you have now is that this judiciary has become captured by a political movement. It's become captured by a very radical political movement. And so, you know, when that happens, you know, it's not a solution to just make it go away, but it could do considerable harm to our country and considerable harm to our democracy if it's left unchecked.
Ian, how do you personally hold on to hope for the future of this country and the court?
Well, I mean, I'm hopeful. I mean, people are energized right now. I look at the same polls that everyone else looks at. And at the end of the day, you know, the way that we are going to solve this is getting more people to the polls than the other guys can. And that's what we have to hold out hope for, is that on election day, people are going to turn out and they're going to say, look, I don't want the world that Brett Kavanaugh wants. I don't want the world that John Roberts wants. And I'm going to keep turning out until we get a better world.
Thank you so much, Ian, for joining us. Is there anything else you'd like to mention?
Well, thank you for having me. You know, please buy the book. I hope it's interesting to folks.
I think it's a great book. When I started to read it, my dad kind of looked at it for a few minutes, and he said he can't wait to read it. When it was missing, I knew what room it was in. So thank you, Ian. Ian's book is available on Amazon. Just search Injustices by Ian Millhiser. You can also find him on Twitter and Facebook, and you see his handles there, iMillhiser on Twitter, Ian Millhiser Public on Facebook, and the book is available on Amazon. And don't forget to enter our drawing for a signed copy of his book by writing the word court. We'll leave the drawing open until 9 a.m. Eastern this Friday, which is July 20th, and the drawing will be held next week on Activate Live, July 25th, after 3 p.m. Eastern time. So good luck to all of you out there. It's a really good read. Many consider it a must read. I'm a slow reader, so I'm still reading it myself. But this is definitely a good book to read. And it puts everything into perspective with the history of the Supreme Court and what's going on in our country now. Well, now it's time for you to grab your pens and pencils, because we're going to give you some dates. And I want to thank everybody who's commenting as well, because I wanted to mention we have so many people that are commenting. Heather Kelly's commenting on Facebook. You can comment on Facebook or Twitter. Just hit the reply button on Twitter. Heather Kelly said, great interview. That was because of Ian, not me. Cindy Williams is watching it as well. Craig Hughes has joined us. Just let's see what else we have here. Heather is saying, we need to empower our union members to fully understand their unified strength. I agree with you, Heather. We used to say that there's strength in numbers. Now we're saying, you know, there's power in numbers, because that is a lot of power when everybody goes to the polls. So we appreciate everyone who's commenting. Now you grab your pens and papers, because we're going to tell you about all the important dates that you have to remember. Registration is due this month for the following classes that are in September. We have EIP 4, Financial Officers, Advanced Local Chairman Development. That deadline's July 22nd. We also have a July 29th deadline for the IAM Young Workers Strategy Program. So get your applications in as soon as possible. All of the information is available there on the website, wimpasinger.iamaw.org, and you can find that website from goiam.org as well. And always check your email as well. Our special events calendar includes our conferences and conventions. The Brotherhood of Railway Carmen Division meets July 23rd. That's just one day before the full TCU IM convention, July 24th to 26th in Nevada. And August 12th to the 17th is the IAM Safety and Health Conference in Hollywood, Maryland. August 8th to the 11th is the LACLA Convention in San Juan, Puerto Rico. We'll have a live report from there. August 23rd to 25th, the Pride at Work Convention in Phoenix, Arizona. We'll have a live report there as well. And in September, the 10th to the 14th, is the Aerospace Conference in Fort Worth, Texas. The deadline is July 31st for that conference there. Sign up for IAMAIL. Just go to goiam.org. That's goiam.org. If you sign up for IAMAIL, you'll get IAM news straight to your inbox in your email every Tuesday and Thursday afternoon, so you can keep up to date on what's going on. A lot of people are commenting with that word court, so they're really interested in this book. It's a good book, Injustices, by Ian Millhiser. So we're glad that all of you are interested in that, and thank you all for watching the interview. Keep the comments coming. And let us know what you think about workers' rights, social justice, and the future of the U.S. Supreme Court. We all have to make our voices heard. And join us next week from the 35th Regular Convention of the Transportation Communications Union in Las Vegas, Nevada. We'll see you from there.